Hello, everybody. Thank you. I'm Teresa, and I am an alcoholic. It's very nice to be here. There's really nowhere I'd rather be than at an AA meeting. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, and talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm thinking about where to go back and where to start from. And I think I'm going to start from my teenage years. I was somebody who really didn't like school very much. I grew up here in San Diego. I graduated from Hilltop High School in Chula Vista. And I was a person who was always a bohemian. I was always artistic. I could sing. I could write music. I could paint, I could draw, I could always do things like that. And I wasn't interested in anything else. I was really only interested in the creative side of life. And all I wanted to do was get out of school as fast as I could, join a rock and roll band, and travel around the country in a van with a bunch of boys. And that's exactly what I did. And I did that for a long time. And I ended up in Washington, D.C. on the East Coast. And I started putting together a music career. And I had aspirations of becoming a famous musician. And I worked very hard at that. And I actually got some success. I think I got what you might call mid-level success in music. I became a working musician. I put out a lot of CDs and traveled and was on the road and toured, and I had a lot of respect as a musician in the community. I also picked up a very severe drug and alcohol habit. That lifestyle is, it's not something that you'd be ashamed of. It goes together. I was up late at night, I was in clubs, I was drinking a lot. And all the other things that go with that, too. So while I was having a wonderful time and pursuing my dream in life, there was a dark side going on for me as well. And I didn't know it. I didn't notice it because it was just going along with the life that I was living. And I started to have experiences that weren't very fun, like getting lost in Southeast Washington, D.C. If anybody's ever been in Washington, D.C., you don't want to get lost in Southeast at 4 o'clock in the morning. But I did, and I was in a blackout, and I got out of my car, and I was wandering around. And the next morning, I woke up in a strange person's apartment, and they were just sitting in the corner looking at me. And I looked at them, and I said, "What am I doing here?" And this poor fellow just looked at me and he said, "I don't know, honey. You just came up here last night and asked if you could come in." And I was very indignant with him. I didn't say, "Thank you for letting me in." I said, "Well, where is my car?" And he said, "I don't know, honey." So I left his apartment, and I went looking for my car. Now, I want you to know that I stood out like a sore thumb in this. It's Sunday morning. I'm in my Saturday night clothes. I've lost my shoes. My stockings have holes in them. And I'm walking around looking for my car. I can't find my car. I go back to this poor old guy's apartment, knock on the door. He opens his door again. I said, "Well, I just have to call the police because I cannot find my car." And he goes, "Okay, honey." He lets me in his house. I call the police. The police come over. I tell them, "Well, I don't know what happened, but something happened last night, and someone must have drugged my drink because I do not remember what was going on, and I now cannot find my car." And the police are just looking at me, and they said, "Well, would you like to get in our car and we'll drive you around and see if we can help you find your car?" And I said, "Yes, I would." So I got in the back of the police car and they were driving me all around and we couldn't find the car. And pretty soon I was leaning up over their seat and trying to give them directions. And they said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, well, I had quite a bit to drink last night, but I'm fine now. And they said, well, we'll tell you what. Let's take you home, and we will continue to look for your car. I said, well, all right, that sounds pretty good. So they took me home, and they went and found my car for me. And then they came back and got me and took me to my car, where I then got in my car and drove home. So, you see, I didn't have any shame about my lifestyle at all. And the police in Washington, D.C. are fairly lenient, which is a good thing. But my luck started running out. After a while, bad things started to happen to me. And I'm sure everybody can relate to this. After the fun is over and the good times are over, and you can kind of feel your clock ticking, like you kind of know when your luck is over. And I started sensing that, and I started breaking down psychologically. So I'd be out at night playing with my band, and it was a hard-working band, too. We had worked very, very hard to get to where we were. We were all on the serious track in music and doing well. And I began to break down psychologically, and I just couldn't deal with the lifestyle anymore. And I started to have some experiences. Like one night I was driving home from a show, and I was really drunk, and I needed to get home because my son wasn't home alone. And I knew that I was going to pass out in my car. And so I was going really, really fast so I could try to get home before I passed out. And I ran a red light, and a policeman came up behind me and pulled me over. And when he came to have me roll down my window, I started crying. And I said, I'm really sorry that I was speeding and ran a red light, but my son is home by himself, and I have to get home. And I was just trying to get home before I passed out. And this, again, this policeman was so nice. He goes, well, I have to take you in. You're really drunk. But he did take me in, but he talked them into letting them set a court date for me and then him taking me home so that my son wouldn't have to be by himself. Now, I'm skipping a real long period of time here. This was about a 20-year span, but because I don't want to take up my 45 minutes with a 20-year drunkalogue, I'm just hitting a couple of the highlights here. So I had a moment of clarity when I got home. My son was waiting for me. He was about 14 at the time. I had spared him nothing. I'd been an alcoholic his whole life. Wasn't ashamed of it. Didn't have any shame at all about it. In fact, I thought I was doing pretty darn well. I was pursuing my career. I was pursuing my dream. I was getting awards in music in the town that I lived in. And I was a small-time celebrity. And I thought I was doing well. And I was looking at my little boy, who's the most wonderful son that anybody could ever have. And I had a moment of clarity that just had to have been a God shot. And he was sitting there in his little sweet self. And I looked at him and I thought, you are ruining his life, just like your parents ruined yours. And it was something I couldn't forget, and I couldn't quit thinking about it. And then I started having these other thoughts. If your hand causes you to steal, cut it off. And I knew what that meant. That meant that I was going to have to quit the band, which may not sound like much, but it was what I had. It gave me an identity, and it made me feel important, and I needed it because I had never had an identity. So I called the policeman the next morning, and I thanked him for getting me out of having to spend the night in jail. That was not like me to call somebody and thank them. I went to court, and I ran into somebody at court that I knew. It was a woman attorney, and she asked me what I was doing there, and I told her. And she looked at me real seriously, and she said, "Teresa, this is a very serious charge." And she said, "You better be careful, because you're going to do some time if you don't watch out. And then who's going to take care of your son? You are all that he has." And I began to get clear, but I didn't begin to get clear. I began to have a series of psychic experiences. And they talk about it in the big book. Some people get sober through experiences of the burning bush variety, and some people go through the educational type, which takes a long, long time. I started to have very dramatic things happen to me. For one thing, I started to listen to people. Now, why I listened to that woman or actually saw the kindness in that policeman, I don't know, because I wasn't like that at all. It was at this time that I began to listen to the voices in my head. And I do not believe it was my own voice. I do believe with all my heart that I began to be guided by angels, or what I call angels. Because everybody in my family is alcoholic. I had never stopped to think about that before, because when you're from alcoholism, you don't think about it. But at this time, I began to think, and I started to try to look back to where I'd made my mistake, because I began to suffer, and I began to be in great psychological pain. And I started to try to go back into my mind at where I had made my mistake, and I couldn't go back far enough. I would have to have not been born. And I started to look and see that everybody, it wasn't just my mother and father, it was my mother, my father, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my siblings, all of us were alcoholic. And I did not know how to change that. So what happened was I did end up quitting the band, and then I got a little job in a hair salon. I got a little job as a manicurist in a hair salon. And I tried to be what I thought a real mother would be. My son was a football player. He was a star football player. He was actually the quarterback on his football team. And he started asking me if I would move to Georgia so he could play Southern football. He wanted to play football in the toughest high school division in the country, which was Georgia or Texas. He had gotten a scholarship to one of the best prep schools in Washington, D.C., and he didn't want to take it because he said they played pussy football. And he talked me into moving to Athens, Georgia. So we packed up our car. We literally duct taped a futon to the roof of our car, put our TV in the car, put our dog in the car, and drove to Georgia. And we did not know one person there. We had very little money. We drove directly to the high school. My son saw the football team down on the field and yelled down there, "Hey, do you need a quarterback?" And the coach said, "Yeah, ours just broke his thumb and we're shit out of luck." So that was that. He was on the team. Mom just had to find a job and a place to live. So we did that. And for the next 3 years, Dusty played football, and I was a mother, which was a new experience for me. I went to every single football game. I tried to join the pep squad. I didn't actually fit in, but I did my best anyway. And my son got a football scholarship, and he started to achieve the things he wanted in life. And after he went to college, guess what happened to me? Take a wild guess. What do you think I started doing again? Drinking. I didn't know what else to do. I did not know how to be a social person. I decided to move back to San Diego, and I did. I was struggling. And what began for me then was a series of angelic interventions. After one night in the bar, I came home the next day. I didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how to meet people. I didn't know how to be with people. So I just started going to bars. Can you tell my background is as a rock and roll singer? So I was writing out a list of what I needed to do that day. I needed to do the laundry. I needed to go grocery shopping. I needed to sweep the floor. And in automatic writing, it said, go to AA. I swear to God. And I looked at that, and I found a meeting. I was living in North Park, and I went to a meeting on Grimm. My first AA meeting was on Grimm Street. And it was indeed very grim. And I walked in there, and I did not know what to make of that place. I didn't know what to make of those people. I had never seen anything like it in my life. I can tell you right now, I didn't like it. And I didn't really go back there again. I tried to make friends with a couple of people. Didn't work out. One of the girls, I asked her if she'd like to come over for a cup of tea. It's my first experience in AA. Trying to be friendly. She said, yeah, she'd come over for a cup of tea. So we sat and drank tea and talked for a while. And she asked if she could use the bathroom. And I said, yes. She went into my bathroom. She came out a completely different person. Now, mind you, I have never met a person in AA before. She comes out. I thought she was kidding. She comes out. She kind of hobbles out with her head down like this. And I didn't know what she was doing. And she goes, there's some people here that would like to meet you. And I'm looking around. I swear to God. And then she started introducing the other people in the room. And I asked her if she'd like me to walk her to her car. So that was, I decided I wasn't going to go back to a meeting at Grimm Street. But God was going to let me quit AA that easily. So the next miracle that happened to me, I hated the place where I lived. It was ugly. The neighbors were mean. The people were nosy. And it was just not very nice. To this day, I do not know who called me. My phone rings, and there's this little voice on the other end. It goes, is this Teresa Gunn? I said, yes, it is. Well, are you looking for a place to live? I said, yeah, I am. Well, my friend has a place over in Coronado, and she's over there right now if you'd like to go take a look at it and see if you might like to move in there. And I said, okay. So I drove over to Coronado thinking the whole time, well, I can't live in Coronado. I could never afford to live in Coronado. So I get to the address, got my dog in the car, and it's this beautiful yellow Victorian home. I think, well, I'll never be able to live there. I get out of the car with my dog, and the little lady's standing there, and she takes me in the apartment. It's this Victorian home. It's been divided into apartments. It's just beautiful. And it's just the prettiest little place you ever saw, and it's exactly what I can afford. Exactly, to the penny. And she goes, oh, yeah, and that includes everything. That includes the cable TV and all the utilities and... Then she looks at my dog and she goes, but we don't allow dogs. But that's such a cute dog. You could just keep that dog. There's no reason your dog can't stay. And then she goes, oh, that'll be the first and last month's rent. Well, I don't have the last month's rent. Oh, that's okay. I know you kids don't have any money. I'm 45 years old, you know. Well, anyway, there's nothing that's going to stop me from moving into this place. I mean, I'm in. That's it. You don't have any money? That's okay. Your dog has fleas? That's okay, too. You're moving into this beautiful place in Coronado. So anyway, I got the place. So I'm sitting there. Where do you think this house is? What do you think it's directly across the street from? The Coronado Alano Club. Now, you can't tell me that God wasn't working in my life. Because he was. But I didn't go. I would just sit in the window of my apartment and cry. And watch the people come in and out of the meetings. And just cry and cry and cry. Because I knew that I couldn't go over there. I just didn't have the courage to go. And I didn't want to go. And I'd had a bad experience at AA. And I just wasn't going to go again. Well, one day I was so lonely. I'll tell you, it wasn't the fear of drinking that got me into AA. It was isolation. It was the fear of being alone for the rest of my life. And I finally got the courage to walk over to a meeting. It was on a Friday night. I'll never forget it. And I walked into the meeting, and the first thing that I remember hearing at an AA meeting was somebody reading out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were saying, the alcoholic has an absolute inability to form a relationship with another human being. And I felt like somebody who had stabbed me in the heart, because that was me. I had an inability to know people, to be a friend, to be intimate on any level. And it really hurt me when I heard that. And I began to go to the meetings, but I would leave early. And I didn't want to talk to anybody, and I didn't want to know anybody. And if people would try to approach me, I would get out of there real quick. And what happened was I started getting very, very angry and kind of mouthing off at the meetings. Yes. And taking exception to the big book, the chapter to the wives was a real bad one for me. The chapter to the wives really got on my nerves. And I didn't mind telling the whole meeting about it either. Well, you can tell that a man wrote this book. Maybe if I had a little wife to take care of me, my life wouldn't be so hard. You people say you're nice? You're not nice. I've been coming here for months and nobody will sponsor me. Where's my sponsor? And then I was in a meeting in IB where I was asked to leave. There was a man there that I thought was very rude. So I just told everybody at the meeting that he was a very rude person and I didn't appreciate his rudeness. And I was escorted out of the meeting. And then, finally, I demanded at the meeting that somebody be my sponsor. You told me to go to meetings, work my steps and get a sponsor. Well, if nobody will be my sponsor, how am I supposed to get a sponsor? Huh? And so then, of course, the biggest nut in the room came up and offered to be my sponsor. This woman had me going to buy her ice cream, returning her books to the library, doing all kinds of chores, and I was thinking, well, this just can't be right. This can't be right. And then one day, it happened. You know what happened to me. I was at a meeting, and I met somebody that I liked a lot. And he liked me too. And he invited me to a special meeting, a meeting with a speaker, a meeting that kind of reminds me of this meeting here, but there was somebody, a big shot from AA talking. Who was that guy? Dr. Paul. So he took me to a meeting where Dr. Paul was the guest speaker, and Dr. Paul's wife was sitting right up front, and Dr. Paul spoke, and he spoke about his marriage, and he spoke about his marriage before sobriety and his marriage after sobriety. And he talked about how he gets up before his wife in the morning, and he doesn't want to make her a cup of coffee. But he does make her a cup of coffee. And he puts an ice cube in it because she doesn't like her coffee too hot. And then he takes her coffee into her and he puts it on her little bedside table so she'll have coffee when she wakes up. And then he said a lot of other nice things about her too. And that meant something to me because I didn't want to be lonely anymore. I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a real relationship. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to have a real life. Well, don't you know that the person that took me to that meeting was strong enough to get through my bad personality for a very long time? And he asked me why I didn't get a real sponsor. Because when he told his sponsor that he'd met a girl he liked, his sponsor said, "Does she have a sponsor?" And so I got a sponsor. And I still have that sponsor today. And that man is still in my life today. I met the man of my dreams and the love of my life at AA. And that man is sitting right in the front row. He was opening the door for me then, and he's been opening my door ever since. So I fell in love in AA, and we've been fighting it out ever since. I'm proud to tell you that I have 18 years sober, and my husband and I have been together for 17 years. The reason I bring that up is because I'm a runner. I don't finish things. And my sponsor told me, alcoholics do beginnings and they do endings, but they don't do middles. So this is the first time in my life I've ever made an effort to do a middle. And the middle is hard. I don't like the middle. You know, I like to pack up and move. I like to duct tape a futon to my car, put the TV and the dog in there, and drive to a new town. I like that feeling. There's nothing I like more than being in a new place where I don't know anybody. But you know, when I walked in here tonight, I've never been to this meeting before. It's a new place. And I don't really know anybody. But the truth is, I know everybody here. I know everybody here. And I never have to be a stranger again. And the longer I'm in AA, the more I love it. I was talking to a woman during the break. And I was talking about my family of origin, the family I grew up in. And I will tell you that I come from a loving family, a talented family, a gifted family, an interesting family, a hard-working family, but an alcoholic family. And my family is terribly alcoholic. And when you grow up in that, you don't know it. So I had nothing to compare my life to. The reason I'm talking about that is because even in AA, it took me years, and I'm talking about at least 10 years, because I started feeling a lot worse before I started feeling better. I'm talking about this for the newcomers, because I have found as an older person in AA that I thought I was going to feel a lot better when I first came in, but I didn't. I felt a lot worse because I suddenly had to feel everything all the time, and I wasn't used to it. I wasn't used to feeling everything, and I didn't yet have my tools in place. I didn't have my backup team in place. I didn't have any trust in place, and so it was very painful for me those first years. And then I began to talk about things at a group level that were inappropriate at an AA meeting. But what I didn't realize was happening was pain from my childhood was starting to bubble up, and I couldn't keep a lid on it anymore. And that's what's supposed to happen. But the kindness of the women in the program is what got me through. I had a woman come up to me and say, "Honey, I know that you're in a lot of pain, but the things that you're talking about at the meeting are not appropriate at the group level. And you probably need to seek out some professional help for those particular issues." So I began to get good and orderly direction, which I had never had. In my family, we were told to run, to hide, never tell anybody if you don't know what you're doing. Never tell anybody if you don't know something. At all costs, don't tell the truth. So it was a very, very, very new thing for me, being in AA. Where my program is today is that I just love AA. I still go to at least 5 meetings a week, sometimes more. I follow the program the way that it's instructed, which to me, they told me, trust God, clean house, and help others. To me, that means trust God means go to meetings. Clean house means work my steps. Help others means help another woman work her steps. And that's how simple I try to keep it. I know that when I first sat down in an AA meeting, even though I didn't get it, and the first person I met had multiple personality disorder, I did notice one thing. I noticed that I had a sense of relief while I was in the meeting. I felt relief. The other thing that I noticed was the hardest time for me in early sobriety was the early evening at dinner time. For some reason, that was the time where I wanted to drink or go out or do something. And I started going to a meeting at that time of day instead. And that's still the time that I go to a meeting. That's still kind of my crazy time. So my program has gotten very, very steady. Something that I thought I would finish up in 12 weeks. There's 12 steps. I thought I'd finish up AA in 12 weeks. 12 steps, a step a week. In 12 weeks, I will have graduated from AA, and I'll be cured of alcoholism, and I'll be moving on. And I remember going up to a lady when I was working my steps and saying, "God, thank God, I'm almost done with these things." She said, "Oh, you're never done." And that really bothered me. I thought, I'm never done. I thought I was going to be done. But she was right. I am never done. I'm still here. The longer I'm here, the more I like it. That's kind of my story in a nutshell. I don't have much more to tell than that. I know there's time left, but I don't really think I have anything else to say. I'll just end by saying that I'm the first person in my family ever to find recovery. I know that this is the work of a power greater than myself. I know that I was saved by grace, and I know that I was saved to help other alcoholics. In my early life, I worked very hard to become a well-known singer, to be a good writer, to be an artist that was known, because I needed an identity, and I wanted an identity. so that I could feel good about myself. But I stand before you today, this group of alcoholics in recovery, and tell you with all my heart today, I know who I am. I have a very strong identity. I'm a recovering alcoholic. That's what I am. Not only am I not ashamed of it, I'm proud of it. On the other side of despair is enlightenment. The longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I believe it quietly in my heart, because we're taught here not to impose our beliefs on other people, that Alcoholics Anonymous is the finest spiritual program on earth. To me, it works. I'm not a person who likes to be told what to do. It takes me a long time to learn things. I have a chip on my shoulder. I've got problems. I came by these problems naturally, believe me. And it's taken me a long, long time. I'm a slow learner, but I'm a thorough learner. And I think I'm through the worst of it. I think I am. I'm not that angry anymore. I don't demand people sponsor me. About once a year, I make a terrible mistake. Once a year, I do it. I'm really trying to at least skip a year now. This year, the worst mistake I made, God, I'm so mad at myself, too. Every year, I promise myself I'm going to get through a year without making a horrible, horrible mistake. This year, I wrote a really horrible, I don't know why I did it, a horrible, it was on a professional level, too, a horrible email about somebody. This was a professional. This wasn't just a schmo. And this is how God tricks me. I accidentally sent it to the person I was talking about. Well, this is an honest program. So the person who's the hardest on me is my husband. And so I knew that I had to tell him the truth. And I knew he was the first person I had to tell, too. And I didn't want to tell him, because I'd much rather tell him about the mistakes that he makes so he can straighten up. But I did tell him. And then I told everybody else, too. I told my sponsor. I told everybody I needed to tell. And then I sent, my husband made me do this, an enormous basket of an edible bouquet to the guy I'd sent the horrible email to. I don't think it made any difference, but it was a gesture anyway. So my quest this year is to try to get through 2013 without doing anything like that. I haven't made it yet, not in 18 years. But who knows? This could be the year. All right. How much time do I have left? I have 8 minutes left. I don't think I can take up 8 more minutes. I'm gonna sing you a little song. I think this song is probably going to be appropriate for AA. This song is called Two Quarts of Beer. I hope I can remember it. Well, I'm sitting here in the heart of Dixie. I'm standing in the shadow of Robert E. Lee. I'm about as lonesome as a poor old Yankee can be. Well, I'm plumb disgusted. I'm lonesome as heck. I'm thinking about love with the proper redneck. I'm drinking white lightning. I'm thinking about you. I'm pissed at my cornbread. I'm crying in my barbecue. Dear mommy and daddy, I guess this is it. Midnight is falling, I feel like shit. I hope that good fortune comes in the new year. I'm going to the store to buy 2 more quarts of beer. Please tell Aunt Stella, hope her diabetes gets better. Tell her next week I will write her a letter. I will enclose her astrology horoscope here. I wonder if Aunt Stella ever drinks too much beer. Tell sister and brother things really ain't dreadful. I got a perfectly good TV set from the Goodwill. Works like a charm and I'm sitting here watching Johnny Carson drinking 2 quarts of beer. Well, Mommy and Daddy, I guess this is it. Christmas is coming, I still look like shit. I hope that good fortune comes in the new year. But I'm going to the store to buy 2 more quarts of, come on everybody, beer. Thank you for letting me be your speaker tonight.